And good morning. Shabbat Shalom and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning scripture study. Thank you so very much for joining us. I thought that it was appropriate this morning for us to just pause and reflect. I know that a lot of people's minds are on that incident that took place now 2 decades ago. It's almost hard to believe in some ways that it's been that long. But it forever changed the face of the world. It changed America. And I think it changed just about every aspect of our existence in the modern world, especially for those of you who, like me, travel. I mean, things like that. But at any rate, it is Shabbat, and we are in the midst of our current study, which I've titled Honest to Moses. We're on a quest. We're looking at the text of the Pentateuch. We're tracing down, if you will, the historicity of Moses and the Moses story, Moses and his time, from the text of the first 5 books traditionally attributed to the hand of Moses. But as you know, now that we are in our 15th class, some of the traditional beliefs that we had have been challenged quite ably, I would say, by scholarship over the last few hundred years. In my last class, I presented biblical evidence that the name of God, namely Jehovah, Yehovah, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, as some might say, that that name was not known prior to the time of Moses. Now, I understand that that is something which can cause a little bit of concern for people who are believers in the biblical text. But we showed forth evidence in a variety of ways from the biblical text, from the text of the Pentateuch, that the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was not known until the time of Moses. Now, apologists, those who think that they are defending the text, will come forward with this idea that the name was known, that it then became forgotten, and then it was remembered again or recovered at a later date. The name was known because obviously there are texts in the book of Genesis prior to the announcement that the name wasn't known. There are texts in the book of Genesis, some 65 texts, I might add, that employ Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, which occurs, by the way, in the Tanakh nearly 7,000 times. But those passages that occur in Genesis are problematic for fundamentalists. In other words, they say, well, I know what you read about Exodus chapter 6, verse 2. I know that, but you must be reading it wrong. Perhaps the grammar allows for a different understanding, perhaps this, perhaps that. And that way, they can explain passages like Genesis chapter 2, verse 4, which is the first occurrence of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, or Genesis chapter 4, verse 26, where it says, then men began to call upon the name Yehovah, and so forth. But I have a simpler solution for you. The simpler solution is that the Bible is telling the truth, that in Exodus chapter 6, where it says, where God says, by my name, Yehovah was not known to the fathers, but I was known by the name El Shaddai, I believe that's true. And I believe that those texts which have the name, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the Tetragrammaton, prior to this point in history, the time of Moses, Exodus chapter 6, that those are later additions, that those are updates, if you will, to the text. They are written into the text after the name was made known, and it's meant to show continuity. Now, as I demonstrated last week, we have strong textual evidence for the revelation of the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in the time of Moses. Very clear, no ambiguity, clearly stated that this name was not known. And so this week, I intend to take that study a bit further. And it's intended to force us to look at the text, to accept the text at face value, and to recognize that which is written in the time of Moses, that which is written later. As I've demonstrated over the past several weeks and months, for instance, in my class on anachronism, which is from the Greek, which means basically backwards time, that these statements, which are updates to the text, it's not that they're not true. It's not that they're not even divinely inspired, or you might say put into the text by divine redaction, if you choose those type of terms. But it's simply to say that we have the ability, by looking carefully at the text, to determine that which dates to the time of Moses and that which dates afterwards. It's very simple. We can also tell from a careful reading of the text that which is most likely to be able to be traced back to the hand of Moses versus that which was clearly written by another. So this week, I intend to take this a little bit further, and I want to begin this exercise by taking a very careful look at Exodus chapter 3 and Exodus chapter 6, and then we're going to go throughout the biblical text. But we're going to look at these texts very carefully. So I want you to go with me this morning, open your Bible to Exodus chapter 3, and I want to read Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 18. I'm reading from the Jewish Publication Society translation. It's not so literal. It's not my favorite translation, but it will work in this case because when I need to go to the Hebrew, I can simply do that. So here we go, Exodus chapter 3 and verse 1. Now Moses, tending the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, drove the flock into the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. An angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire out of a bush. He gazed, and there was a bush all aflame, yet the bush was not consumed. Moses said, I must turn aside to look at this marvelous sight. Why doesn't the bush burn up? When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to look, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. He answered, Here am I. And he said, Do not come closer. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you stand is holy ground. I am, he said, the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And the Lord continued, I have marked well the plight of my people in Egypt, and have heeded their outcry because of their taskmasters. Yes, I am mindful of their sufferings. I have come down to rescue them from the Egyptians and to bring them out of that land to a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the region of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. Now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. Moreover, I have seen how the Egyptians oppress them. Come, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, and you shall free my people, the Israelites, from Egypt. And Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and free the Israelites from Egypt? And he said, I will be with you. That shall be your sign that it was I who sent you. And when you have freed the people from Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Moses said to God, When I come to the Israelites and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. He continued, Thus shall you say to the Israelites, Ehyeh sent me to you. And God said further to Moses, Thus you shall speak to the Israelites. The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, had sent me to you. This shall be my name forever. This my appellation for all eternity. Go and assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me and said, I've taken note of you and of what is being done to you in Egypt, and I have declared, I will take you out of the misery of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. They will listen to you. Then you shall go with the elders of Israel to the king of Egypt, and you shall say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, manifested himself to us. Now, therefore, let us go a distance of 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to the Lord our God. Now, I know that's a lot of text to begin with, but I feel like it's important because this is where it begins. This text in Exodus chapter 3 is the beginning of the revelation of the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now, I read from an English translation which uses the Lord, capital L-O-R-D, all caps. But in the Hebrew text, what we see is that here the God is introducing himself based on a name. And I should be so bold to say a new name, an unknown name to the Israelites. Now, Moses is among the people of Midian at this time. Now, I like to keep it straight because people tend to think that Midian is a place on the map that you can go out and put, in fact, some biblical cartographers will do this and they'll say, this is the land of Midian. I think that that is as effective as tracking down the land of Narnia. Midian and Midianites were a desert people, much like Bedouins today. I've covered that in previous classes, based on the ancient Semitic desert root, D-N, Midian, Bedouin. I think that it indicates the desert. Midian means from the desert, and this is according to Ross, and Bedouin is associated with in the desert. You have the ba, the bait is typically in Semitic languages, that labial sound ba or pa is often associated with the word in, whereas the mim is associated with from. So the Midianite people, he's among the Midianites. He's fled Egypt. He is under the care of a priest of Midian by the name of Jethro or Reuel or Hobab, depending on which source in the Pentateuch you look to. And he drives within the grazing territory of these desert folks, these Midianites. He is on the far side of the wilderness, which typically Achar in Hebrew can be associated with west. So he's in the western area of the wilderness, of the Midbar. Another very specific geographic reference. It's general in some ways, but we have to distinguish in the biblical text between the Midbar, the Negev, the Arava, all of these different words, Yeshimon, these different words in the Hebrew Bible. So he's grazing in the grazing territory of the Midianites. He's in the far side of the wilderness, and he comes upon, as it puts it in the Bible, towards Horeb, the mountain of God. So I want you to recognize that this revelation takes place at a mountain. And I should be more clear to say the mountain. The mountain, the mountain of God. And he comes upon a sight that puzzles him. It's a bush. We're talking about the story of the bush, Exodus 3. He comes upon a bush that is on fire, but it doesn't consume. It's just burning before his eyes. As he approaches, he's told to take off his shoes. The question becomes, who's in the bush? Who is in the bush? In verse 2, we get an indication that it's the Malach, the messenger, as sometimes translations say, the angel of the Lord. The Malach is in the bush. Let me open the text, because as we work through, you'll see this interesting switching back and forth to where it creates questions as to the identity of the one with whom he speaks. In verse 2, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire. The Malach Yehovah, Dr. Tabor taught on that a couple of weeks ago. And he gazes and he sees. Now look at verse 4. And when Jehovah saw that he turned aside to look. So is it Jehovah in the bush? Is it the Malach Yehovah in the bush? Or are they the same? Or is the second occurrence here in chapter 3, verse 4, when Jehovah sees, does he see from within the bush? I'm asking, whose eyes are looking out from the burning bush? This is the question. But notice in verse 4, when Jehovah saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the bush. So is it the Malach? Is it Jehovah? Or is it Elohim? Or are they all three the same? And I know some of you are jumping up and down answering all these questions. Stick with me. In verse 6, the one in the bush says, I'm your father's God. Elohei Avika. Elohei. Now we're going to, I'm going to leave these terms as I discuss them untranslated. But just understand that Elohei is typically translated as God of. So it's a construct type, God of your father. And then he breaks it down, Elohei Avraham, Elohei Yitzhak, Elohei Yaakov, God of, this is the way it's translated, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. But we're going to get into over the next few weeks, is that an adequate translation for El, Eloah, Elohei, Elohim? Moses hides his face because it says he is afraid to look to Ha Elohim. So now we have another word. So we've got the Malach Yehovah, we've got Yehovah, we've got Elohei, we've got Elohim, Ha Elohim. And then in verse 7, and Yehovah said. Now some of you just, you read right over this and you think, oh, okay, well, it's Elohim, Yehovah, Malach Yehovah, Elohei, all of this is the same, but I want you to pay close attention to the details. In verse 7, and Jehovah said, and then it says, and Moses said to the Elohim. This is important for our study today, this background. Verse 12 is interesting. Let's look at that. And this is following the question, Moses said to the Elohim, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and free the Israelites from Egypt? And he said, Ehye. He said, I will be with you. Ki Ehye imach, because I will be with you. Notice the Hebrew that I just said, Ehye. Ki, because, Ehye, with you. Because I will be with you. You shall serve Ha Elohim upon this mountain. Exodus chapter 3, verse 12. I'm working through to establish a few things before I get into, as we say, the meat of the matter today. And Moses said in verse 13, and Moses said to Ha Elohim, here, or behold, hine, I'm coming to the children of Israel, and I'll say to them, your father's God sent me to you. It's interesting that he doesn't say, our father's God sent me to you. But that's another matter altogether. And they'll say to me, what's his name? Now, this is a valid concern. Moses is going to appear before the children of Israel. He's going to declare to them that the God of their fathers has met with him, which is a private revelation of which they have not been part of. So he wonders if they're going to believe him at all. But he certainly wants to be ready when they ask the tough question. Okay, Moses, you said that the God of our fathers came to you. What's his name? It's like a password. And he says, what shall I say to them? Now get this, Elohim, verse 14 of chapter 3 in Exodus, says to Moses, Ehye Asher Ehye. This is the Hebrew, obviously. Now remember, prior in verse 12, it says, Ki Ehye Imak, because I will be with you. Some translations will translate this in Exodus 3:14 as, I am that I am, or I will be what I will be. The trick is, Ehye is based upon the root in Hebrew, Hayah, which means to be or existence. So he's basically saying, I will be whatever I will be. Sort of a non-specific, more of a broad, I'll be whatever I want to be. It's a lot different than giving a specific name at this point. Ehye, you tell the children of Israel, thus you shall say the children of Israel, Ehye has sent me to you. Now the question is, if this is what he tells the children of Israel, will they say, yep, that's his name, Ehye. I know that. I've been raised on this. I know the name of God. It is, in fact, Ehye. Ehye has sent you to us. Come on in, Moses. But then, verse 15, Elohim says further to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, Yehovah, or Jehovah, some say Yahweh, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Elohe of your fathers, translated God of your fathers, Elohe Abraham, Elohe Isaac, Elohe Yaakov, this God, Yehovah, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Then he says, he sent me to you. This is my name. Still the God. The one in the bush is still speaking. This is my name, Leolam. A lot of times this is translated forever. Leolam literally means for an age. An indeterminate age. So in English we say, this is my name, Shemi, my name, forever. But Leolam, look this up. Do a word study. Olam means age. So he's revealing that this Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is his name for an age. Indeterminate. Don't know how long in the future. And this is how I am to be remembered. In the Hebrew it says, Lador Dor. For generation or to generation of generation. Go, Moses. Go and gather the children of Israel and say to them, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Yehovah, Elohe of your fathers, has appeared to me. He says this three times. He he makes this very, very clear. He stresses this point. The God of your fathers, God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. You're going to say to the king of Egypt, Yehovah, Elohe of the Hebrews has called upon us, and now we have to go, please, the word na in Hebrew is there. You're supposed to tell the Pharaoh, we'd like to go, please, a three-day journey or a three-day path into the Midbar, the desert, to sacrifice to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh Eloheinu, Jehovah, our El, or our Elohe. Now, by the way, if you'll notice, this is very interesting because Moses does not know this name before this point. We're in Exodus 3. And when he gets the name, he's to go to the children of Israel, tell them this name. He's also to go to the elders and also go to the Egyptian hierarchy, the Pharaoh, and tell him this name. Sometime later, we don't know exactly how long based upon the text, after his encounter at Horeb, he and Aaron do appear before Pharaoh. And this is what they said. Thus says Yehovah, Elohe of Israel, Shalak et ami, send forth my people. You who've listened to my classes know that I prefer Shalak et ami. I see this not as a jussive, not as a let my people go. It's send my people forth, Shalak et ami. Now, I want you to notice what Pharaoh says. Go to Exodus 5. Exodus 5. And verse 1. Afterward, Moses and Aaron went and said to Pharaoh, thus says Jehovah, the God of Israel, let my people go that they may celebrate a festival for me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh said, who is Jehovah that I should heed him and let Israel go? I do not know Jehovah, nor will I let Israel go. Who is Jehovah? This is a Pharaoh. The Israelites have lived among the Egyptians for hundreds of years. This new Pharaoh, at least, has never heard of Jehovah. Now, based on what we just read in Exodus chapter 3, Moses and Aaron might have said, we didn't know the name either. Because here's the thing. By the time of the Exodus narrative, by the end of it, they all know who Jehovah is. Because one of the things that I want you to remember is that throughout the narrative of the Exodus, one of the things that is stressed is this. God went and made a name for himself. How many times does it say that? You've probably done a Passover Seder, and you'll notice over and over that God's name would be known, that God's name would be known. He has to make his name known through this watershed event that we call the Exodus. So if you look at verse 3 of chapter 5 in Exodus, they answered, after he says, I don't know who Jehovah is, the God of the Hebrews has manifested himself to us. Let us go, we pray, please, a distance of 3 days into the wilderness to sacrifice to Jehovah our God, lest he strike us with pestilence or sword. So what they tell him is that this name Jehovah that they just announced to him is the Elohe HaIvrim, the God, in air quotes, because that's the way it's typically translated, of the Hebrews. We have to go to sacrifice to Jehovah Eloheinu. And Moses, look down at verse 22 of chapter 5, Exodus. Then Moses returned to Jehovah and said, Oh, Lord, why did you bring harm upon this people? Why did you send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he's dealt worse with this people, and still you've not delivered your people. Because if you remember, when Moses and Aaron go before Pharaoh, he says, not only do I not know this God that you speak of, I don't even know why you think I should let him go when you give me the name of an unknown God to me. And furthermore, I won't let him go. And oh, by the way, you've come to me and you're keeping the people from work, so I'm going to make it harder on them. Not only do they have to give us the same number of bricks, but they have to get their own straw. Remember, so it makes it harder. Now we get to chapter 6 of Exodus. And we're going to read verses 1 through 9 and establish a few more points. Then Jehovah said to Moses, "You shall soon see what I will do to Pharaoh. He shall let them go because of a greater might. Indeed, because of a greater might, he shall drive them from his land." And God spoke to Moses and said, now this is Elohim, spoke to Moses and said to him, "I am Jehovah. I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, but I did not make myself known to them by my name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land in which they lived as sojourners. I had now heard the moaning of the Israelites because the Egyptians are holding them in bondage, and I've remembered my covenant. Say therefore to the Israelite people, Ani Yehovah, I am Jehovah. I will free you from the labors of the Egyptians and deliver you from their bondage. I'll redeem you with an outstretched arm and through extraordinary chastisements, and I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God. And you shall know that I, Jehovah, am your God who freed you from the labors of the Egyptians. I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'll give it to you for a possession, I, Jehovah." But when Moses told this to the Israelites, they would not listen to Moses, their spirits crushed by cruel bondage. Elohim spoke to Moses, and he said, "Ani Yehovah." So we have Elohim, the narrator, tells us that Elohim speaks to Moses. You see that? The narrator, the redactor, the compiler of these stories is telling us that it's Elohim who's speaking, and Elohim says, "I am Jehovah." Furthermore, this editor says, in the name of this God, I'm using God because it's our word that we know, when this divine being speaks, he says, "I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and Jacob as El Shaddai, and my name, Yehovah, Noah was known to them." We would clean that up grammatically, syntactically, and say, "I was not known to them by my name, Jehovah." But per the text, now this is where it gets exciting. This is why you're here this morning. This is where the apologist in the audience is raising their hands saying, "Oh, but Ross, the name was known, and then it was forgotten, and now it's brought back into the story. Surely, Ross, you know their text which used the name prior to Exodus 6:2. Exodus 6:2 says, "I wasn't known by the name Jehovah. I was known as El Shaddai." Now, look, I know there are people out there who look for loopholes and they try to find a way to explain away this very clearly stated Hebrew, and it can't be done. I spent the week challenging myself, looking at academic articles, very strongly presented cases to try to explain how this can fit in with the previous uses of the name. So I'm going to go through a couple of those for you, just so you know that I know that the name does occur prior to this, and specifically in the days of the patriarchs. So, for instance, we all know that Genesis 2:4 is the first occurrence of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. We also know that in Genesis chapter 4, verse 26, it says, "Then men began to call upon the name of Jehovah." But I want to look specifically at the days of the patriarchs. Let's go through a couple of these. Look at Genesis chapter 13. Genesis chapter 13 and verse 4. It says, let's go back to verse 2. "Now Abram was very rich in cattle, silver, and gold, and he proceeded by stages from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been formerly, between Bethel and Ai, the site of the altar that he had built there at first. And there Avram invoked Jehovah by name." Now, Exodus 6:2 would say, No. He wasn't known by the name Jehovah. But here we've got a text, Genesis 13, that says he invoked Jehovah by name. Look at 15. Genesis 15. "But Avram said, O Lord God, what can you give me, seeing that I shall die childless?" Well, there again, there's the name. Look at chapter 22. These are Abraham. Genesis 22 and verse 14. By the way, this is another interesting story. Who is speaking in this particular story? Read through it carefully and notice the switching back and forth. But 22:14, "And Abraham named that site Adonai Yireh, whence the present saying, on the mount of Jehovah there is a vision." Now, this is an interesting one. The JPS says Adonai Yireh, and it means Adonai. In fact, the Hebrew text there says Adonai. This isn't a sensitivity issue. This isn't a substitution for the divine name. The Hebrew actually has Adonai. But notice, on the mount of Jehovah there is a vision, or on the mount of the Lord, where it says in the JPS, whence the present saying. The Hebrew says something more closely to, we would say, this day on the mount of the Lord there is a vision, indicating that Adonai Yireh was what Abraham said, but later we would say, on the mount of Jehovah there is vision. All right, you see that? Now look at verse 16, 22:16, or verse 15. "The angel of the Lord, Jehovah, called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I swear, Jehovah declares, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your favored one, etc., etc." So here we've got another text that deals with the patriarchal period in which the divine name is part of the narrative. Now look at chapter 26, Genesis 26, and verse 22. "He moved from there and dug yet another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he called it Rehovot, saying, Now at last, Jehovah has granted us ample space to increase in the land. Well, so there we have Isaac, according to the narrator, using the divine name. Look at verse 25. So he built an altar there, Isaac, and invoked Jehovah by name. Huh. Now, some of you are saying, well, this must mean that Exodus 6:2 is misunderstood or not translated properly or something. You know, because we seem to have this discrepancy. Now look at chapter 28 of Genesis. I'm just going through the patriarchal. Genesis 28, verse 13. And Jehovah was standing beside him, and he said, I am Jehovah, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac, the ground on which you are lying, I will assign to you and to your offspring, and so forth. Now, what I propose is that the text has been updated to reflect the period of Moses or after, without getting too specific on the date. I believe that Exodus chapter 6 makes perfect sense that originally, in the days of the patriarchs prior to the time of Moses, that the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was not known. But at a time when these texts are updated, that the narrator, the redactor, the final compiler wants to ensure, for good reason, by the way, that we understand that the God from the time of Moses forward is the same God as it was prior. That the God who reveals himself as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to Moses is the same God who revealed himself to Noah as Elohim, and only Elohim, to Abraham as El Shaddai, and to Moses as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, that they're all the same. You can go through those narratives and see. The point is, there is a continuity, and the text had been updated. El Shaddai. The most natural way to read Exodus chapter 6, verse 2 and following is to understand that prior to the time of Moses, the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was not known among the Hebrews, nor even the Egyptians. Let me ask you, at least the Pharaoh of the Exodus, I should say. Here's the leader of Egypt. A massive group of people live in the midst of his people, and he's never heard the name Jehovah, if it was known and referred to, because we know biblically there was no ban on pronouncing the name. People used it in common speech, biblically. I'm not talking about what came about later in post-biblical Judaism, which we see today. I'm talking about in the biblical period when people prayed, when they greeted one another on the street, they would say, Jehovah be with you and with you, sir. You know, it's just common language when people made vows, when people prayed, when they spoke, when they swore. Deuteronomy in two passages says you should swear by the name Jehovah. So the name was commonly used. So if it was commonly used in the time of Moses, you mean to tell me that the Pharaoh had never heard this name? I guess it's possible, but I think it's a bit hard to believe. I think that he's introduced to the name. I think he's telling the truth when in Exodus 5:2, when he says, I don't know Jehovah, never heard of him, I'm not letting you go. I think that's true. And I think that by the end of the story, he very well knows who Jehovah is. I think he does, don't you? Now, as far as the texts are concerned, I think what we see is a progressive revelation, again, which is later updated. We don't know who did the updating. There is not a shred of textual evidence as to who those scribes or who those later editors were. There's not a single reference which gives us any very substantial proof as to who that might have been. But we do believe that the text was maintained by the Leviticals, the Levitical group. We get that throughout the Pentateuch and beyond, particularly in Deuteronomy. You know, in Deuteronomy 31, the text is given to the Levites and so forth. Now, as I pointed out in my last class, we have no personal names. This is another evidence that the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was not known prior to the time of Moses. We have no evidence of names, human names, that have the theophoric element, the Yahwistic or the Yahwistic element added to it. Later we do, later in biblical period, from the Judges on through the conquest, through the monarchy, we see over and over and over, Yehonatan, Yehoyachaz, Yeho, you know, Yeho, Yeho. That name is very, very popular. That element, that divine name element is very popular in the name of people. But prior to that, in the Pentateuch, get this, in the five books of Moses, from the death of Moses, go back, go back, go back, all the way to the creation, we don't have but one. One name that without any doubt, there's one other that is a maybe, but I don't think it is. But either way, the two names, the one for sure and the one that's iffy, both of them come from the time of Moses. No other name. Now think about that. That employs the name. Look, just so you have it in this class, look at Numbers 13. Numbers 13, I think I covered this last week, but just to show you one more time. Numbers 13, 8. From the tribe of Ephraim, we have Hoshea, son of Nun. We have Hoshea, son of Nun. Now look at verse 16. Those were the names of the men whom Moses sent to scout the land. But Moses changed the name of Hoshea, just mentioned, son of Nun, to Yehoshua. English says Joshua. In Hebrew, it's Yehoshua. So Moses takes Hoshea, the son of Nun, and he says, your name is now Yehoshua. He's the right-hand man. He's the one who's going to help execute the plan to bring the children of Israel to the land of promise. And that's the only occurrence that is not disputed that indicates to me with a good degree of certainty that the name Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh was not known prior to the time of Moses. Now, Ehye, Elohim, Yehovah in Exodus chapter 6, 2, all of them are used. They make it clear that while his name, his newly revealed memorial, Lador Dor, for generation to generation, Yehovah, while that was not known prior, it's stressed that that God, that deity, was known. And for those who believe the Bible, he was known as El Shaddai to the patriarchs. Now let's see if this concurs with the textual evidence. Go with me to Genesis 17. Genesis 17. When Avram, verse 1, when Avram was 99 years old, look, Jehovah appeared to Abram and said to him, come on, Ross. There it is right there. This is an editor. Now watch what Jehovah says. I am El Shaddai. Walk in my ways and be blameless, and I will establish my covenant between me and you, and I will make you exceedingly numerous. And then Avram threw himself on his face, and God spoke to him further. As for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be a father of a multitude of nations, and you shall no longer be called Avram, but your name shall be Avraham, for I will make you the father of a multitude of nations, and I will make you exceedingly fertile, and make nations of you, and kings shall come forth from you. I will maintain my covenant between me and you and your offspring to come as an everlasting covenant throughout the ages to be God to you and to your offspring to come. I assign the land you sojourn in and to your offspring to come, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting holding. I will be their God. Elohim further said to Abraham, as for you, you and your offspring shall keep my covenant, so forth. Now, the redactor, the editor, the final compiler includes Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh when Elohim in this narrative, but when the deity speaks, he doesn't say, I am Jehovah. He says, Ani El Shaddai, Ani El Shaddai, Ani El Shaddai, I am El Shaddai. Perfect opportunity for him to introduce himself as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, if that were the case. Notice that in this narrative, whenever El Shaddai, when it's giving the narrative, it says Elohim. So the deity is referred to as Elohim within the narrative. It introduces it as Jehovah spoke, but when he speaks, he says Ani El Shaddai, and then Elohim is used throughout. Now look at Isaac. Let's go to Genesis 28, Genesis 28, 1 through 4. So Isaac sent for Jacob and blessed him. He instructed him, saying, you shall not take a wife from among the Canaanite women. Up, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Betuel, your mother's father. Notice that Betuel is a theophoric name. Betuel, your mother's father, and take a wife there from among the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. May El Shaddai bless you, make you fertile and numerous so that you become an assembly of people. May he grant you the blessing of Abraham to you and your offspring, that you may possess the land where you are sojourning, which God assigned to Abram. Or Abraham, all right? So notice we have the blessings and the covenantal promise tied to El Shaddai. Now, some of your translations may translate that. They may say God Almighty or something like that. We'll get to that. El Shaddai is the Hebrew. Now, look at Genesis 35. So we've got a couple of examples more in the patriarchal period. 35. Verse 9 through 12. God appeared again to Jacob. By the way, this is Elohim appeared again to Jacob on his arrival from Paddan Aram, and he said, and he blessed him. And then verse 10, Elohim said to him, Elohim, you whose name is Jacob, you shall be called Jacob no more, but Israel shall be your name. And thus he named him Israel. And God said to him, Ani El Shaddai, I am El Shaddai, be fertile and increase. A nation, yea, an assembly of nations shall descend from you. Kings shall issue from your loins. The land that I assigned to Abraham and Isaac I assigned to you, and to your offspring to come will I assign the land. All right. Elohim appeared. Elohim says to Jacob, Ani El Shaddai. So when Elohim speaks, you go, give the microphone. Elohim speaks, Elohim says, Ani El Shaddai. I am El Shaddai. And then what follows are the blessing and covenantal promises. And then in verse 13, look, God parted from him at the spot where he had spoken to him. In Hebrew, it says Elohim went up. What does that mean? I don't know. I mean, did he just walk up the hill or did he just poof? We have examples of both in the Tanakh, so... Notice in verse 15, Jacob gave the site where Elohim had spoken to him the name Beit El. See, it's the Beit El. It's not Beit Yehovah, it's Beit El. El is the name. Now, we're going to get into this very deeply next week because some of you are saying, no, 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 Ross, El is just a title. It's not a name. Well, we'll get to that. Genesis 43. Genesis 43 and verse 11 through 14. Genesis 43, 11 through 14. Then their father, Israel, said to them, and by the way, this is the back and forth. Joseph is in Egypt and Jacob is sending the boys trying to appease the Lord of the land, who happens to be Joseph, but don't tell anyone. They don't know that yet. Then their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, do this. Take some of the choice products of the land in your bags. Carry them down as a gift for the man, some balm, some honey, gum, ladanum, pistachio nuts. Man, I love pistachios. And almonds. And take with you double the money, carrying back with you the money that was replaced in the mouth of your bags. Perhaps it was a mistake. Take your brother too. And go back at once to the man, and may El Shaddai dispose the man to mercy towards you, that he may release to you your other brother as well as Benjamin. As for me, if I am bereaved, I shall be bereaved. When Jacob sends the boys and wants to send them with a blessing and protection, he says El Shaddai. Look at chapter 48. 48. People are going to be surprised over the next couple of weeks. Genesis 48, verse 3 and 4. And Jacob said to Joseph, El Shaddai appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and he blessed me and said to me, I'll make you fertile and numerous, making of you a company of peoples, and I will assign this land to your offspring to come for an everlasting possession. Blessing, covenantal promise, Elohim is used throughout. But here we have Jacob telling Joseph that God's name is El Shaddai. In the narrative elsewhere, it's Elohim. So Elohim, what is Elohim called by the patriarchs? El Shaddai. Now, when Jacob to Joseph in the blessing, look at chapter 49, Genesis 49 and verse 25. This is the blessings of Jacob to his sons as he's on his deathbed. This is part of Joseph's blessing, verse 25, 49, chapter 49. The God of your father who helps you, Shaddai, who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that couches below, blessings of the breast and womb. Shaddai. Notice in this text, it doesn't say El Shaddai. It simply says Shaddai. So he's blessing Joseph. In the blessing, he associates the God of the fathers with Shaddai. Notice that the words of the blessing, blessings of breast and womb. Interestingly enough, in this text, breast is Shaddaim. It's the dual form of Hebrew, but body parts are often presented in the dual form. In Hebrew, you have a singular and a plural, but you also have a dual form, things that come in twos. You can say oznoi, ears. You can say hands, yadaim. You can say feet. And so in breast, Shaddaim is a dual form. Now, the interesting thing is that there are some who propose that the name Shaddai is based on the idea of breast. And you think about a breast and how it nurtures. So there are people who say, you know, El Shaddai is the one who nurtures, or the one, it's the mystics get into this and they say it's the feminine aspect of the deity and so forth. But we're gonna take this a little bit further. I've got a little bit more to go through. But it is true, I will tell you, that Shaddai, Shin Dalet Yud, is based upon a root word that is Shin Dalet or Shin Dalet Hey. So it does have the same letters as breast. All right, but there's a reason for that that a lot of people have missed. Now, go with me quickly, the book of Numbers, Numbers chapter 24. Numbers chapter 24 and verse 4. Now, this is a pagan. I like calling him a pagan. Bilam, Bilam of talking donkey fame. Bilam, the son of Beor, Numbers 24, verse 4. The words of him who hears God's speech, who beholds visions from Shaddai. So here is Bilam, the son of Beor. He hears the words of El, or the sayings of El. We don't know what El means yet. You think you do, but we don't know yet. That's another class. And he sees the visions of Shaddai. Look at verse 16, chapter 24. The words of him who hears God's speech, who obtains knowledge from the Most High, and beholds visions from the Almighty. Hears the words or sayings of El. Knows the knowledge of Elyon. Ah, it's a different word. Elyon means the highest. And then it says, sees the visions of Shaddai. Now, by the way, El Shaddai, I gave you the examples from the Pentateuch. There's only one verse in the Tanakh outside of the Pentateuch which uses El Shaddai. Only one. It's Ezekiel 10:5. Ezekiel 10:5. It's not part of my class today. You can look it up, though. Elsewhere, Shaddai occurs as a name. Shaddai occurs, not El Shaddai, Shaddai, in Isaiah, Ezekiel, Joel, Psalm, 31 times in the book of Job, and then one time in the book of Ruth. Now, Job, the date of which is highly debated. The book of Job, the date of Job is highly debated. The reason is it contains language which scholars puzzle over. So, for instance, some of the language tends to have an affinity with language of the post-exilic period, the Persian period. So we see things in Job that would push Job into beyond the exile, right? Persian period. And so one example is in Zechariah 3, the way that the writer talks about Hasatan, the Satan, the adversary, the opposer, and so forth, that belief system seems to be influenced from Persian belief. And we find something similar in the book of Job, nowhere else in the Bible. So some scholars push Job to a late date. But there is also within Job the affinity with very ancient literature, very ancient beliefs. The setting of Job, if you read the story, this was, by the way, believe it or not, when I came back to God as a young man in my 20s, for some reason, I picked up the book of Job, and that was the first book I read. So it's very interesting to me. Now, the book of Job, the setting gives you the feeling of the patriarchal period. Its location, it's in the land of Uz, O-O-T-Z, Uz, I think is the way I grew up with it in the Baptist church. Job from the land of Uz. But it's actually Uz. Epho, where is Uz? Go with me to Lamentations. I just want to show you where Lamentations is. I want to show you where that is too. But I want to show you where the land of Uz is. Lamentations chapter 4, verse 21. This is important. Why do we have 31 occurrences of the name El Shaddai? Look at this. Chapter 4, verse 21 of Lamentations. Rejoice and exult, fair Edom, who dwell in the land of Uz. So Edom is associated with the land of Uz, the setting for the book of Job. Now, where is that? Well, the land of Edom, it does move, the boundaries move over time in the biblical period, but generally it is south. Generally, it is west and east of the Arava. If you look at the map, the Jordan River Valley, the land of Edom throughout history often extended on both sides of the Arava and southward. In different times of their strength, as the strength of Edom waxed and waned, the borders grew east-west and north-south. But that's generally where it is. So it's east. In Hebrew, we talk about Kedem. Kedem and the Kedemites are generally associated with the people of the east, east of the Jordan. Doesn't need to be very east, but it can be very east. Now, there are other clues as to the writing and the setting of the book of Job. The Kedemites, by the way, I just have in my notes, you look at it later, 1 Kings 5:10, the Kedemites, the easterly people, are known from their wisdom, the wisdom of the people of the east. Now, look at Job chapter 1, verse 15. Job 1:15. I want to quickly go through a few more points as we wrap up. Job 1:15, or 1:13, let's start. One day, as his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the house of their eldest brother, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, the she-asses were grazing alongside them, when Sabians attacked them and carried them off and put the boys to the sword, I alone have escaped to tell you." What a tragic piece of news. Your boys are dead. And the Sabians did it. Who are the Sabians? Sabians in Hebrew is Shavah. It's this also, you'll recognize, remember the queen of Sheba? It's this people, people of the east. So we're in this region, south, east and west of the Arava, more easterly. And it's talking about people from the east came in and they committed this crime. Now look at chapter 2 of Job, verse 11. Perhaps the bulk, or not perhaps, the bulk of the book is the message, the encounter, the dialogue between Job and three friends. Verse 11, when Job's three friends heard about all this calamity that had befallen him, each came from his home. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. All right, so here come his friends. With friends like these, who needs enemies? Eliphaz and Zophar are described as Kedemites. Eliphaz is from Teman. Teman is in the region of Edom. Remember in Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 3, where it talks about God coming from this region? Look, these people, by the way, in Habakkuk 3, 3, it's Eloah. Eloah from Teman. It's this theophany from this region, Teman, Edom. These people have known God, these desert-dwelling people in this mountainous region have known God throughout history. By the way, Shuhi is a son of Abraham by Keturah. That's the name comes from the Keturah line. Now remember in Genesis 25? In Genesis 25, Abraham sends the children of Keturah away to the land of the east from Beersheba. So he's going east, right, to these desert locations. Read this on your own, Genesis 25. El Shaddai and Shaddai represent an early name for God. I know that people are saying, no, these are just titles. Until he comes to Moses and reveals his name, he's only known by titles. Stay tuned. Edom, Teman, Paran, or I should say Paran, Kedem, all are associated with revelations of El or Ha Elohim. These mountainous regions. When Jehovah revealed his name to Moses as Jehovah, he's at Horeb, the mountain of God, as we would say. Har HaElohim, towards Horeb, Har HaElohim. And I see a connection with El Shaddai and these desert mountainous regions. It's now accepted almost universally. You always have an outlier. That El Shaddai does not mean God Almighty. The traditional translation, God Almighty, where El equals God, Shaddai equals Almighty. I challenge you and say that both of those are wrong. Various proposals have been put forward for both components, for El and Shaddai. Shad, as I pointed out a few moments ago, can mean breast. But I see this definition as derivative from something else. In other words, breast is called shad because it is generally shaped as a mount or a mound. So it's a derivative. Like, I don't have to be more descriptive. You can put this together. The idea is that a mountain or a hillock or a mount is a swelling place, basically. Now, notice in Genesis 17 again, I wanted to read a couple of notes from scholars to make this point. Genesis 17, it says in the JSB, if you have the Jewish Study Bible, by the way, I know I recommend a lot of books from time to time, but the footnotes in here are fantastic. So Genesis 17, verse 1, it says, this is a footnote. By the way, this is the first occurrence of El Shaddai. El Shaddai is believed to have originally meant God, the one of the mountain. El, the one of the mountain. And thus to have expressed the association of a deity with his mountain abode, well known in Canaanite literature. In the priestly conception, the four-letter name translated as Lord was disclosed only in the time of Moses, Exodus 6, 2-3. And El Shaddai was the name by which God revealed himself to the patriarchs. Well, that's interesting. Sounds familiar. Now look with me to the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth and chapter 4 of the book of Ruth. Chapter 1, Ruth 1, verse 20. Do not call me Naomi, she replied, Ruth 1:20. Call me Mara, for Shaddai has made my lot very bitter. So here we've got Naomi, who was living in the land of Moab. Now, most of the rest of the book of Ruth refers to God as Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. But she's talking in this context. You know, if you read the story, you'll see she's just out of Moab. And so what I want to point out is it's from this region, from this land, that also Balak sends for Balaam, who also from the plains of Moab uses this phrase, Shaddai. And he's from the east. Look with me, one other thing. Look at Numbers 22, and I am wrapping this up. Numbers 22, this is back to the book of Bilam, as the Talmud calls it. Numbers 22, verse 5. Balak, son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at the time, sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor in Petor, which is by the Euphrates in the land of his kinfolk, to invite him, saying, there's a people that came out of Egypt, and so forth. Now, this fetching of Bilam from the east, notice this footnote. This is interesting. Bilam, the son of Beor, in Petor, the seer, Bilam is a seer, right, of De'ir Allah inscription. So let me make this point clear. There was an inscription discovered called the De'ir Allah inscription, and it bears the name of Bilam. So they discovered an inscription in stone of a seer by the name of Bilam. The place name Petor, Bilam's home, is usually identified as a site on the Sajur River in Syria, some 400 miles from Moab. Now, here's the interesting thing. There's a connection here. The description of the discovery of the inscription at Deir Allah with the name Allah, I mean with the name Bilam, Richard Elliot Friedman points this out in his commentary. Listen to this. This is from Genesis 17. Again, first occurrence of El Shaddai. El Shaddai means El, the one of the mountain. The old translation, God Almighty, cannot be justified. The associations of God in general and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in particular with mountains is well known. And there are gods called Sadu-Rabu, big mountains. It means big mountains in Akkadian. And gods called Shadin in the De'er Allah text. So we have gods referred to in this inscription, De'er Allah, that mentions this seer by the name of Bilam. It also mentions gods called Shadin in the De'er Allah text. El Shaddai, then, does not mean God Almighty. Shaddai associates the El of the fathers with the one of the mountain. And by the way, a specific mountain. The one from the mountain was known as such until the time of Moses. The question is, why does he reveal his other name to Moses at this place for the first time? Perhaps John Langberg's right. John told me yesterday, we were discussing, he said, nobody ever asked him. Could be that simple. Could be. But what about El, Eloah, Elohim? Are these, as we have been told, only titles and not a name? Ladies and gentlemen, God's first name is El Shaddai. El, the one of the mountain. But what is El? If Shaddai is mountains, what is El? For that, you have to join me next Saturday. Shabbat Shalom, Shavua Tov. Have a beautiful week.